So welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Evan Hirsch. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm excited to get into your story. Just to give people a bit of context about Evan, Dr. Evan Hirsch suffered with fatigue for 5 years before he achieved resolution using the Fix Your Fatigue program that he pioneered in his medical practice. Through his best-selling book, free Facebook group one-on-one and group and one-on-one coaching, he has helped thousands of people across the nation optimize their energy and is on a mission to help 1 million more. He is board certified in family medicine and integrative medicine. And when he's not at the office, you can find him singing musicals, dancing and playing basketball with his family. And Evan has promised that all of those will be part of the interview today. So, I think probably the best starting point would be to start off a bit with your story, the fact that you personally suffered with fatigue, and I know that also your wife had some experience with it as well. Tell us a bit about that and how that kind of turned your path as a perhaps more traditional medic into working in this field.
Happy to do so, Alex, and thanks for that introduction. So I had gone through conventional medical school. I was entering into family medicine residency. University of Washington has a program in Olympia, Washington, where I was. And I got started. I met my wife about a month in. She was living and working in Olympia, and we fell in love. And about 3 months later, she couldn't get out of bed. So it was just this really rapid decline. And I felt incredibly powerless. Here I was supposed to be at the top of my game, learning everything that I could about family medicine and medicine in general. I would ask my attendings, every doctor that I came across, all these books that I was reading, and there really wasn't much that conventional medicine had to offer about fatigue. You know, there was thyroid, and there was certain severe illnesses like lung disease and heart disease and hepatitis and stuff like that. And all of those were ruled out. And here she was, couldn't get out of the bed. We finally found a naturopath that was able to do an adrenal stress index test and found that her cortisol levels had flatlined. But that was about it. She said, you know, I don't really have much for you. Stacy did some research on her own, bought a sauna, took some adrenals, and she was fortunately able to come out of her fatigue about 3 years later.
So it must have been a pretty challenging experience when you're seeing patients day after day and you're helping them and the person that you're closest to in the world feeling somewhat powerless to be able to help.
Exactly. And I was, you know, working 80 hours a week. You know, I was trying to find the time to support her and to do this research, you know, filled me with a lot of shame and a lot of guilt that I wasn't able to help this person that I loved. And so then I graduated residency in 2007, and then we got married and had a child, and I opened my own practice. And then in 2010, my energy started to tank, and I developed chronic fatigue, and that lasted for 5 years. And what I found through that process, I mean, first off, it was horrible, as you know. My brain fog was so bad that here I am sitting across from a patient, and I could barely remember anything about them. You know, I could remain focused for the appointment, but then once they were gone, thank goodness I had electronic medical record because I couldn't remember their name. Wow. And so that was really challenging. And I could only work for a few hours a day, and I had 2,500 square feet of space and all the staff and a lot of overhead and expenses. And so I had to bring on other practitioners and try to train them in my ways. And I was already practicing functional medicine. I had come out of residency, and that was the first training that I did in September 2007, and I was already board certified in holistic medicine and doing a lot of more holistic things. And here I was, you know, stuck with fatigue and couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. So that started my path and my journey on trying to find the causes. And so that's just what I did in terms of reading books and in terms of going to conferences. And every single time somebody would talk about fatigue, I would gather it as a potential cause to examine, and I would test it out on my patients. And I found that, you know, with every single cause that I would resolve, I would get a little bit better. But it was only after I figured out all of the causes that I had and got over them that I really was able to resolve my fatigue and achieve all the energy that I have today. And I saw that same thing happen with my patients over and over again, where, you know, I would get them to a certain level and then I would go off to a conference, learn more, and I would come back and then I would apply that, and then they would get even better, and then I would go off and I'd learn more. So, and then the next time I had a new patient, then I could apply all of that stuff that I had learned and get them better even faster. So that was my journey.
Well, one of the things that I really appreciated reading your book was, and I'm sure it wasn't something that you appreciated being the person suffering, but I appreciated the fact that there wasn't one single piece of the jigsaw. And I always find it a little bit disconcerting when somebody's had a relatively simple resolution, because what tends to happen is they tend to become overly passionate about that one piece of the jigsaw. And in some ways, because your recovery path was quite complicated and there were different twists and turns and different pieces that helped you take the next step, it sounds like it gave you a much deeper appreciation of the complexity of these conditions.
Absolutely. You know, it's that curiosity for when you've got somebody sitting in front of you that you can't help, to be like, okay, well, what am I missing? And it was that same thing with myself. And yeah, time and time again, and I keep on adding more and more causes to kind of understanding this complex web. And, you know, you learned very early on from my understanding about the emotional component. And for me, I came to it later, in part because that was a lot of the work that Stacy, my wife, had done. But I've only gotten into it more recently and really noticed the big uptick in my energy and my fulfillment in my life as I started really getting more into mindfulness and into mindset.
Very interesting and very, very cool. It's, I guess, for people that are watching or listening, which are, I'm assuming they're here either because they themselves or clients they're working with, or some, you know, one of their loved ones is affected by fatigue. But I think it'd be helpful just to explore a bit, how does someone know they have fatigue?
So I see fatigue as a spectrum. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, but I'm just going to kind of start off with the definition of the, you know, basic fatigue is tiredness that's not relieved by rest. So if you are sleeping 8 hours a night and you are still tired, or you need coffee to get through your day, or you need a 5-hour energy drink, then there's something else going on that the body is saying, hey, you need to pay attention. And that's kind of what I see fatigue as, is it's a flag that's being waved that's saying, pay attention. And then it's that spectrum, you know, that can go all the way to, you know, the CDC and the Institute of Medicine and whatever kind of diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome or ME that you want.
Because there may be people that are watching or listening that don't meet the diagnostic criteria for chronic fatigue or ME, for example, but they kind of normalize to a level of deficiency of energy, which actually isn't normal. And there's a kind of, it's often surprises me when you see people that have got so used to having to kind of crash at weekends and go to bed, you know, 2-3 hours earlier than they otherwise would, and no longer doing sport and are not going out kind of in the evenings. And it's like their life has kind of got smaller and smaller, but because they're perhaps not meeting diagnostic criteria, they're thinking that it's what's happening is normal. When of course it's a helpful the way you lay it out as a spectrum, that someone might not have chronic fatigue, or they might have, but they may still well qualify as not that someone wants to qualify with, but to be appropriate for finding solutions and finding ways to get back to a normal level of functioning.
Absolutely. And the diagnosis really should be based off of these causes instead of these symptoms. You know, if you have a certain number of symptoms for a certain amount of time, then we're going to classify you into this diagnosis, but we really can't help you with it.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, it's really doing people a disservice, though having a label can be very helpful to people. But I think having a label of a cause or causes would be even more helpful, to say, hey, you know, I've got fatigue because I've got mold, Lyme, and adrenal dysfunction. You know, I think that would be a lot more supportive and help people understand that there is a problem and that they're not crazy, rather than, you know, getting this label from the conventional establishment that doesn't really mean anything or help out at all.
And of course, it's such a kind of unhelpful label. It's a little bit like someone going in and you know, I remember when I was diagnosed, and I was effectively saying, I'm exhausted all of the time, I can't function. And then you get a diagnosis of chronic fatigue and it's like, yes, I know that's what I told you, but what's wrong with me? And something that I liked in your book as well is you said that finding the causes is more important than the treatment. And often what people will tend to do is they're, of course, so focused on getting out of the situation that they're in. And often practitioners, even if they're working from a conventional point of view and they're perhaps limited to their understanding, they still want to help the patient. So there tends to be this strong focus on immediately trying to find something to do without taking that time to fully understand what the causes are. So maybe it'd be helpful just to open up a little bit. I know that, and it may be that it's evolved since some of your work that I was reading, but I think you defined 15 different potential causes. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that piece.
Absolutely. So these 15 causes can really be grouped into deficiencies and toxicities. And the deficiencies are deficiencies in hormones like adrenals, thyroid, sex hormones, deficiencies in nutrients, vitamins and minerals, antioxidants. It can be deficiencies in some of the lifestyle stuff like deficiencies in water, dehydration, deficiencies in exercise, though a lot of our folks can't exercise, but sometimes a lack of exercise can also be a cause of fatigue. You can have deficiencies in good food, of course, you know, not getting the nutrients that you need, but also the energy of the food. And then there's the toxicity. So we're talking about heavy metals, chemicals, molds, infections, allergies, negative emotions, electromagnetic frequencies, basically all the crap that we're exposed to that we come into this life and get flooded at us that we need to get rid of out of our body. And a lot of us, you know, have this combination of a toxicity that we've received causes a deficiency, and then our genes are not allowing us to get rid of that toxicity. There are some people who, you know, get big hits of mercury and they're able to get rid of it and they don't get fatigue or they get less fatigue than somebody over here who gets a big hit, they can't detoxify, and then maybe they get another hit of mold or another hit of something else, and then all of a sudden they have fatigue. So that makes it so much more complicated. I tell people there's like 15 nails in the bottom of your foot, and we can get rid of the gluten nail and we can get rid of the candida nail, but you're not going to see big shifts until you also get rid of like the mold and the lime nail, you know? And so it's, you get this mass effect when you get rid of a number of the 15. And most of the people that I see, that you probably see too, have all 15.
Yes. Yeah. I've found myself saying to patients sometimes that if there wasn't so much human suffering involved, it would be the most fascinating jigsaw puzzle to put together. Which of course it is a fascinating jigsaw puzzle, but one has to be considerate of that. It's that can land in a bit of a strange way to the patient who's like, I'm suffering. I don't want to be suffering anymore. But before we come into a bit more detail, some of those pieces that you mentioned, and I know you have a 4-step process in terms of how you kind of work through that in sequence. I think a lot of patients or people suffering from fatigue have been to a number of different practitioners or physicians and have not got as far as they would like. And I think they can feel like they're the most difficult patients in the world without ever wishing or intending to be difficult. From your perspective, why do you think fatigue can be so tricky for practitioners to work with?
So the reason why that is because everybody has multiple causes of fatigue, right? So it's never just the one, you know, it's not Occam's razor where, you know, one cause is causing all of the person's symptoms. So it's multiple causes. And then everybody has different multiple causes. So there's 15 causes, and this person over here might have causes 2, 7, 9, 10, and 11, and this person over here might have 1, 5, 13, whatever, you know? And so they are, and they might show up with very similar looking symptoms. And so that's the challenge. And so then this person says, well, so-and-so over here took this and this and this, and they got better, and I took those things and it didn't work. And it makes it that much more confusing because once again, they're focused on the treatment, which is very much a conventional medicine sort of thing, is that you look at the research and this treatment helps this condition based off of the research instead of actually looking at what's under that symptom, what's under that condition, and what is the actual cause, and really dovetailing down into those causes, finding those causes, and then removing them.
And how important do you find in your work that the sequence of approaching those causes is, because it seems that one can approach the right pieces in the wrong order and it not be as effective. And I'm just curious as to if that's something that you observe and how you approach the sequencing of what order you do things in.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very important. And sometimes it does change a little bit. And I'll talk about that in a second. But and it's a perfect dovetail into the four-step process. Yeah. Is that all right if I jump in there?
Yeah, please do.
So
yeah.
The four-step process that I found to be most effective is to first assess. So that's determining all of those causes, you know, leaving no stone unturned, because you don't want to look back 6 to 12 months from now and say, oh, I wish we got a mold test, a mycotoxin test to determine if you got mold in your body or in your home. Okay, so that's the first step to assess. The next step is to make the person as strong as possible with where they're at. So that's where the replace comes in, or replacing the deficiencies. So that's adrenals, thyroid, sex hormones, nutrients, figuring out what causes are there and boosting the person up, because that's going to help with detoxification. That's going to help with their energy, their mood, their ability to then step into doing things like modifying their diet, being able to work and not having the additional stress of being overwhelmed and coming home and crashing on the couch. So that's step two, is replace. Then step three is to set us up for step four. Step three is to open up the detoxification pathways. So most of the time when we have the toxicities, they're clogging up our detox pathways. So liver, kidney, lymph, neurolymph, basically the lymph in the brain, you know, all of those things are going to be clogged up and you're not going to be able to get rid of the toxins, which is step four, removing the toxins, which is the heavy metals, chemicals, molds, infections, allergies, negative emotions, and EMFs. And emotions definitely go throughout the whole entire process. But that's what I found to be most effective. Now, there are some variations. So if somebody is chemically sensitive and they can't tolerate, you know, a lot of the stuff in terms of replacing, we may have to look at how to decrease their total body burden, basically all the crap that they've been exposed to that's causing their immune system to react to everything, in order for them to be able to tolerate anything that I give them. So that's one of the modifications that we look at. But I find that process to be incredibly supportive across the board.
So going back to break these down in a bit more detail. So the first one being to assess. So to assess the causes, what's the process that you go through with patients, and how much of that is kind of clinical observation and experience, and how much of that is functional medicine testing that you're using?
It's both. So, you know, I talk a lot about what we can gain from subjective experience and what we can gain from objective data. And we just need to gather all the data possible. And so that's combining the symptoms, the history of what's happened to you, you know, your response to certain treatments, and then looking at objective data. So, you know, a bloody nose, that's actually objective because somebody else can see it. So that's a sign as opposed to a symptom. And then also looking at the laboratory tests. So there are certain things that you can do subjectively. So in the first visit with folks, I can do a lot of replacing because I can do a lot of that subjectively. I can determine based off of their symptoms and their history, adrenals, thyroid, sex hormones, mitochondrial dysfunction. Those are kind of the big ones. But then for the objective stuff, the lab data helps with that and confirms that, but it's really needed also with the heavy metals, chemicals, molds. They can all look exactly alike. Infections can be done symptomatically. I recently did a masterclass on this because I just find it so interesting. But even the Centers for Disease Control will say that, you know, certain tests for Lyme, like the Western blot, are meant for epidemiologic studies and not for diagnosis, but that a lot of these infections are clinical diagnoses based off of symptoms. And so, for example, you know, you look at an infection like Bartonella, and if somebody's got pain on the bottom of the feet with muscle cramps, headaches, neck pain, problem sleeping, anxiety, depression, thyroid, then they have three or four of those, and it's very likely they've got Bartonella or Borrelia, Lyme. Basically, you cannot have Borrelia if you don't have either muscle pain, joint pain, or nerve pain that moves around the body and comes and goes. So, you know, those things you can do subjectively based off of the symptoms, but it's really the combination of those that's really helpful and really powerful.
And I guess that's also, I think about that as almost being the art that goes alongside the science of diagnosis, that it's like when you sat in front of hundreds or thousands of patients, that it's almost a little bit like you start seeing the Matrix, right? You kind of start going, oh, that bit and that bit, I remember that bit there and that links there. And it's kind of, that's the piece where it's people can do a lot to help themselves, but a really skilled clinician such as yourself can start to kind of map it partly through all that data, but also through the ability to kind of join the dots and kind of connect the pieces to build the picture and make sense of that data.
Absolutely.
So it's interesting that stage two in your four-step process is replacing deficiencies and starting to build up the system. And I'm interested in that partly from a sequencing point of view, that one of the things that I've observed over the years is that practitioners can sometimes, at least it appears to me in my opinion, to be quite quick to go in and work on detoxing the system or start kind of going after things like mold or Lyme or whatever. And the system's already so depleted that it's kind of doesn't have the resilience or the capacity to work with that. So I was really interested to see that you placed the building up, as it were, before the kind of throwing in the atomic bombs in terms of taking on those things. So maybe say a bit about what's informed your that part of your approach.
You're exactly right. I'm glad that you brought that up, because when you go after those toxicities, it's stressful on the body. It's stressful to remove them. And so you have to have some sort of stress mitigation process, you know, and that is really making sure that you're as strong as you are, making sure that you can handle the stress, because the stress is going to happen. The stressor is going to happen. And that's going to create this whole cascade of increasing cortisol and other adrenal hormones. Thyroid's going to try to help out. Mitochondria, you know, and if they're not well supported, then the person just crashes. And, you know, I call this picking up the pieces, where, you know, somebody comes to me from a practitioner who is a Lyme specialist or a mold specialist, and that's all they do. So they definitely mean well, and they, you know, they're doing the best they can. But then the person, they may say, oh yeah, your Lyme is completely gone, but the person still can't get off the couch. In fact, sometimes they're worse. And it's because the stress of the treatment was, you know, harder than the actual disease that they were having. So super important to build them up. And the reason why I found this out was because, you know, I had tried that before, and I had found that, oh, you know, as people were getting worse, I was like, okay, well, let's build this stuff up and let's try to create this balance. And then I was like, what am I doing? Let's just build them up so that we can deal with it. Because there's still going to be this art that you have to deal with as you're trying to get rid of the crap and the stress that it's putting on the body, and how you have to then adjust the thyroid and the adrenals and stuff like that too. So I tell people, yes, the replacing is a band-aid, and we always want to get at the root cause. But right now, in order to get at the root cause and remove that crap that caused this deficiency, we have to boost you up and make you stronger with this band-aid.
It's interesting the point you make as well around, if you go to a Lyme specialist, they're going to see Lyme and they're going to treat Lyme. I remember one of my first teachers saying to me, you know, Alex, if you go to a butcher's and you say, what should I have for dinner tonight? What are they going to tell you have for dinner? I don't know, but it's going to have meat in it. If you go to a fishmonger's, it's going to have fish in it. And if you go to the organic food store, it's probably not going to have meat or fish in it. But it's a kind of that kind of lens through which people look. And that's why also I appreciate the way that you're kind of coming at this, that there's different pieces of the jigsaw in different people, and it's somewhat dangerous to get overly fixated on one piece, because if you look for it, you can see it whether it's there or not in a sense. So you move from replacing deficiencies, and actually before we move on for that, just perhaps particularly for practitioners that are listening, what are some of the ways that you like to work with that? So in terms of working with adrenals and thyroid and sex hormones, for example. Is that through supplementation such as glandulars? Is it through bioidentical hormones? What are some of the ways that you find helpful there?
A lot of glandulars. So, I mean, and herbs. So, you know, it's a 95% natural protocol. The only things that I will prescribe from time to time is going to be thyroid and then bioidentical hormones. But I do try to do it as natural as possible for folks. And so, like, for adrenals, I'm a big fan of Eleuthera root, hawthorn. You know, I'll use some combination of adaptogens, but I like something that's strong and stimulating, that's going to get things moving. I like to use things that are strong so we can really shift the needle, but not so strong that we're going to have negative effects. So that's kind of what I've spent my career looking for. Thyroid. And so I do ramp ups on each of these things that I kind of talk about in the book, you know, that it's really subjective ramp ups, where oftentimes the body's going to give us clues about how high to go. So for example, with thyroid, you know, we can test free T4 and free T3, but if somebody has low thyroid and you want to give them a glandular that has both or also some 1 and 2, and you just start ramping them up by like a capsule every 2 weeks or so, they're going to let you know when they get hyperthyroid. You give them the clues and say, hey, look for these things. But once they get hyperthyroid, then you come back to that previous dose, and that's pretty close to where they need to be. Now, you know, you always have to take into account that there's a ratio that exists between the adrenals and the thyroid, and then an internal, and the sex hormones, and then an internal ratio within the thyroid for the different T3, T4 sort of thing. So that gets into more of the complexity, but you can ramp up on these things gradually over time. And as long as you're doing them in isolation, that you can get the data that you need and their reaction to it, it can be incredibly supportive. So, that's kind of what I'll use for a lot of these.
I really like that approach to dosing as well. I always get nervous when people just start kind of going, this is the dose I have to be on without the listening. And it's certainly we find with a lot of the more sensitive patients that you have to go sometimes fractions of a capsule, like people kind of breaking things up or getting kind of capsules apart and pouring a few grains of powder in some water or whatever to just gradually build up the capacity and tolerance.
Well, and I find too that with the chemically sensitive folks, that topical works really well. You know, 80% of the immune system's in the gut. Anything you throw down the gullet has the potential for a reaction. So topical can be really helpful, as well as, of course, the lifestyle stuff. Like, you know, if you're going to detox, maybe a coffee enema, sauna, you know, is going to be best for you rather than taking something orally.
Yeah, very cool. So then coming on to opening up the detox pathways, say a bit more about some of the ways that you do that, and perhaps a bit more also about why that's, you touched on it earlier, but why that's important before then coming into stage four of the process.
So the way that I like to think about it is kind of from the toes up. You know, you have to be pooping regularly, you have to be peeing regularly and making sure that the kidney pathways are open. You have to make sure that liver pathways are open, then into the lymph, which dumps into the liver, right? And then neural lymph, which dumps into the lymph. So that's kind of the order that I think about it. So, you know, there'll be certain things that I will use. I'll use magnesium to bowel tolerance. I'll use Cascata Sagrada and some other formulas to make sure that people are stooling appropriately. And then, you know, moving into the liver and kidneys, there's, you know, there's milk thistle and there's skullcap and a number of other things. I like certain formulas. There's a great formula by Byron White, and there's a great formula by Cellcore that I really like, kidney liver detox. So I kind of start adding these things in, you know, slowly and incrementally. And then moving into the lymph, you know, once again, these products by these different companies, Byron White Formula has a BT detox and the lymphatic detox by Cellcore products. And I don't remember all the components. That's why I'm giving the names, so you can go look them up. And then the neural lymph also, there's an NT detox product by Byron White that I really like. So a number of these herbs, which are really great for working at different levels for opening up these pathways, and I ramp them up. You know, I really like the tinctures as opposed to the capsules because you have more control. You can do them topically if you need to. But that's kind of, that's the process that gets started. If somebody is able to move, so whether that's jumping jacks, whether that's some sort of exercise, that's going to be great for opening up the lymph, you know, rebounding, you know, doing some yoga, even if it's really gentle yoga, bringing the knees to the chest to straighten out the intestines and wind relieving pose. So there's a lot of really good things that you can do castor oil packs, you know, to really start to get these processes moving. But once again, I like stuff that's strong so we can, you know, make movement and continue to move the needle.
It's really interesting what you're saying about the lymph, because one of the challenges, of course, is that when people are at the more severe end of the fatigue spectrum is that they're not able to move the body. And people often think that exercise is about weight loss and fitness, and they don't realize that actually just movement can be around supporting detoxification. And it could be, as you described, as simple as just very gentle movement that just at least kind of helps facilitate that process. Out of interest, and this is probably a hard question to answer because I'm guessing the answer is that it's different for everyone, but in terms of the amount of time that a patient might spend in the kind of the replacement deficiencies and the kind of building up phase, amount of time they might spend in the kind of opening up the detox pathways, and then, as we'll come to it a bit in a moment, the kind of removing toxicities, is there a kind of amount of time you might spend at different stages of the protocol?
So my goal is pretty much 3 months per stage, you know, and that we've got resolution by 12 months. So, you know, the first 3 months we're talking about replacing deficiencies and we're assessing. So we're kind of doing both of those at the same time. And then once we've assessed and we found all the causes, you know, then all of a sudden now all the roads are ahead of us, and then we can start removing a lot of the crap and opening up the pathways for another 3 months. So then we're sitting at 6 months, and then it's removing the crap for the next 6 months. Now, depending on the number of causes that someone has, each one of those processes could be 6 to 12 months in length in terms of like removing heavy metals, removing chemicals, removing molds. Now, oftentimes you can layer them on top of each other, so it takes 6 to 12 months for all of them. But if somebody is not able to tolerate treatment and you have to go slower or whatever, that's when it starts to take more time. That's when it starts to take longer than a year, you know, 2 years, 3 years, whatever.
And often in those cases, it's people that have been ill for 20 years. And so actually, as much as people might be hearing this that have just started to show signs of fatigue, then they're more likely to be the quicker cases, I would guess. Although,
absolutely.
I don't know about you, but there's a interesting thing that I've noticed over the years, which sometimes those that have been ill the longest can also be the easiest to work with, because they're just like, just tell me what to do. They've done so many challenging treatment protocols already that they're kind of military personnel, which are just used to being in a war zone and right, kind of arrive and chuck their bags down and go and play a video game, like, let's get on with it sort of thing. It's a kind of attitude of kind of getting on with it. Whereas if someone's a bit earlier in the process, it takes a bit more coaching, a bit more time to make some of the more basic changes because they feel more radical. I don't know if that's something that you see.
A little bit. I mean, there's also kind of, you know, do you have the energy to take the protocol? You know, I mean, that becomes a challenge as well. So, you know, the people who are, you know, so motivated, who still have the energy to be able to take the protocol where, you know, it's just been the last couple of years that they've been sick. Those are the people I see, you know, who make the biggest shifts. Those people who have been sickest the longest, oftentimes there's a huge emotional component that either they're not willing to look at, you know, or they haven't found the right practitioner, or they haven't found the right technique. And so, you know, working with somebody who's knowledgeable in NARM, you know, for trauma, or in EMDR or NLP or hypnotherapy or whatever it is to try to make those shifts, tends to be really helpful. But yeah, I find that the emotional trauma is really the thing that ends up taking the longest to resolve.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is can be true with people that have been in a long time is that there can be what can appear to be a negativity is actually a self-protective mechanism. There's a fear of optimism because of the continual disappointment. So there's almost an unwillingness to invest hope in something in a self-protective capacity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just had a conversation with somebody the other day, and it wasn't going well. And that's what I figured out, is that it was a self-protective, and they weren't going to let themselves hope because they'd been disappointed too many times.
Yeah. Yeah. So coming a bit more into some of the ways that you work with removing toxicities, and I guess it's also a place to bring in a bit more around kind of chronic infections and kind of Lyme and Bartonella, some of the other pieces that you mentioned. So how do you, if you see, well, perhaps let's break down a bit more of those pieces, then I get you to preempt my next question, is also, I'm curious as to how you decide the sequence of working with those pieces, if you know that there's more than one that's going on. But maybe just to slow it down a bit, say a bit more about, so you mentioned earlier mold, heavy metals, Lyme. So yeah, just explore that a bit more, please.
So I'm a big fan of binders. And I've especially gotten into some of the newer binders, the bioactive carbons, which is really exciting because you don't have to take them away from food and supplements because of the size of the molecules, which is really exciting. But we're talking about like humic and fulvic acids, which not only will bind, but they will also remineralize. So they're not going to be binding to minerals. So they're multifaceted and can really be supportive. And oftentimes, depending on the different components, can bind up radiation, heavy metals, chemicals, and molds. So you can get a lot done by utilizing these binders in resolving numerous causes. You know, you want to make sure that somebody's not being exposed to these things any longer, that they don't have the mercury fillings in their teeth, that they are not eating tuna fish all the time like I did growing up, which gave me all the mercury that I had, that they're not being exposed to one of the 84,000 chemicals in the U.S. anyway that haven't been properly examined by the FDA, you know, that they're not living in a moldy home. So we have to make sure we remove the offending agent, right? And then doing the binding. If they don't have access to the bioactive carbon binders, then, you know, activated charcoal can be great. Just has to be taken 90 minutes away from all food and supplements. Byron White Formulas also has a great product called Detox 2, which I really like. That's an hour away from food and supplements. So that's how I start with those. Sometimes there's also, you know, depending on the kind of success that we're having as we repeat testing for heavy metals. Oh, and I should say that, you know, it's all about, you know, you talked about, you know, starting low and going slow. And that's kind of like my whole motto, is that we want to be taking baby steps. As long as we're moving in a forward progress, we're going to get there, you know. And so we just want to take baby steps, and we want to make sure that this process, which really is like a two steps forward, one step back sort of process, does not become a one step forward and two steps back. So a slow and steady detoxification is really advised. And so then as we start to bind and as we start to pull these things out, we can increase a lot of the things that are opening the pathway. We can start binding to some of these things more, maybe some chelating agents, cilantro, chlorella, some of those things if we need to shift things a little bit more. I used to use DMSA pharmaceutical to pull out heavy metals, but I saw that too much was being recirculated. So now my process is really a much slower detoxification. But I find that by doing this process with those binders, that I can get really good success with heavy metals, with chemicals and molds. The other thing that's important to remember is that as you remove those, a lot of those clogs that have been clogging up the detoxification pathways are removed, and the body is naturally going to start removing those pathways on its own.
And how do you, when you're looking at a patient which clearly has chronic infections and kind of an overload that's going on, do you use, in terms of deciding if it's mold, if it's Lyme, and actually I really liked what you were saying earlier in the interview around that there are certain pictures of symptoms which will kind of be clues around that. But what's your process that you go through to identify, which of these pieces are going on for someone? Because it can appear quite similar in terms of the symptom picture.
So you mean in terms of the testing?
Yeah, in terms of the testing, and in terms of also then, it sounds like what you sometimes are doing is taking a kind of using binders that have a kind of fairly generic impact. So regardless of whether it's toxic mold or it's Lyme, that you're still going to have benefit. But if you've got all of those going on, if there are different protocols, how are you deciding which to work with first?
So, you know, I always like to go after the low hanging fruit, you know, so it's what's going to be easiest to remove that's going to be best tolerated. Because if we can pull that nail out, that just gets us closer to our goal, right? So that's one of the things that I look at. And then in terms of the labs, you know, I look at, you know, for heavy metals, I'm looking at a provocated urine test. So utilizing the DMSA, well, basically they wake up in the morning, they urinate into a box or into a cup and put it in the box. And then that's kind of a baseline. Then they take DMSA, like a certain amount based off of their weight, and then they collect their urine for the next 6 hours. And it's that comparison from the before and after that can be incredibly helpful. If it's, you know, 10 times normal, it can be significant, so that you're really individualizing it for the person, because it's important to remember that the heavy metals are really going to be contained in the tissues. And so you need to use that DMSA to chelate, pull it out in order to be able to test. So that's the test that I like for heavy metals. For chemicals, I like a urine chemical test through Great Plains Labs. That's a great one. And the heavy metal test, I like Doctor's Data test. The urine mycotoxin test by Great Plains Labs as well is a wonderful test. And for the chemical and the mycotoxin test, I do recommend a week-long provocation with liposomal glutathione. It's usually 500 milligrams twice a day for 7 days, and then doing these other tests. And then the test that I like best for Lyme and its co-infections is the DNAconnections.com test, which is a urine PCR test. So that's looking at DNA of the bug in the urine. Now, the provocation for that test is basically a lymph provocation, which some patients cannot tolerate, but it's basically exercising hard for 30 minutes so that you can expel things out of the lymph, or getting a lymph massage and then doing the test right afterwards, because you're basically trying to push the bugs out of the lymph system into the bloodstream and then collect them into the urine. So that's great for Lyme and Lyme-type infections in order to corroborate the symptoms that we're seeing. But then for some of the other infections like viruses, you do need to look at serology. So this is looking at the immune system's reactivity to the bug. And that's really dependent, though, unfortunately, on the intact nature of the immune system. So if the immune system is distracted by heavy metals, chemicals, and molds, it probably isn't going to be accurate when you're looking at how it's reacting to some of these infections. So some of that has to be based on symptoms alone. And then to determine exactly how you go after these is, you know, I'll do the binding. I'll look at just that order that I looked at, like heavy metals, chemicals, and molds. Well, actually, I'll do molds, chemicals, heavy metals, and then infections. But it really also depends on how patient a patient is, because if and how obvious their symptoms are. So if somebody is kind of through the first three steps, and you know, we know that infections seem to be the number one thing, like they've, you know, they're screaming Bartonella or Babesia, which is like sweating all the time, really hard time sleeping, really bad depression and anxiety, and a cough or some sort of lung issue, that I'll say, okay, well, let's do this, and we can do low dose of that and see how you respond. And as long as those pathways are open enough, then we can definitely make some shifts on that. So, you know, it's also this process of meeting them where they're at and engendering trust, so that, you know, they can see, you know, what you're doing, and that, you know, once they start to feel better, they're going to trust you a lot more, and they're going to be a lot more willing to go through the process with you.
And how often do you have contact with patients in this part of the process? And particularly, I guess, those which are highly sensitive and it becomes quite tricky, and each thing they try, they react to. How do you coach and support people through that process?
So I have several different programs. I've got a program that's face-to-face for an hour every month. I've got a program that's twice a month. I've got a program, and then as people graduate, then they can move on to every 6 weeks or every 3 months. But I'm always available by secure messaging. And I get back to people within 2 business days. So yeah, they always can have access to me, you know, with any sort of questions they have along the way. And I always want to hear from you if you're not doing well, because I don't want a month to go by me to say, how you doing? And you're saying the same, or, you know, I got this happened and then I stopped it or whatever. I want us to continue to make progress. So you have to communicate with me.
And I'm curious as to, given the experience you've had with both your own personal and your wife's journey and the number of people that you support and work with, how do you know if you can help someone? Like how do you kind of assess how well people are going to do with your program and the way that you work?
So it's really about the causes. You know, if I haven't talked about anything today, hopefully people are walking away being like, okay, what are my causes of fatigue? And that's what I should be thinking about when I'm looking at a patient. You know, what are the causes of this person? So if somebody has evaluated and treated all of the causes and they still have fatigue, I probably can't help them. You know, I'm happy to help them try to figure out what the other potential cause might be that is not even on my radar yet. But so that's the thing that I always look at. And so if they haven't, and 9 times out of 10, they haven't looked and they haven't found all of those causes. And so how can you possibly expect to be done and resolved your fatigue if you don't know what all the causes are because you haven't even treated them?
Makes sense. But before we come to how people can find out more about you and your work, I'm always curious. When you have a patient in front of you, and you alluded to a patient like this a little bit earlier, where they kind of feel like they've tried everything, even when you can recognize they haven't tried everything, and there's a certain level of disillusionment or a lack of kind of trust of medics because they've been through such a tough kind of journey. What do you tend to say in those situations? What do you find helps break through some of that fear and some of that resistance that people can have?
It comes down to the causes. It comes down to asking the questions. You know, it's not about what I tell them, it's what I ask them, right? So I say, okay, well, have you found this cause? Have you done this test? Have you? And the no's just start building up. And then I say, hopefully you can see that you haven't found all the causes. Because, you know, humans really understand root cause. They understand that there's a cause to everything and that if you find the cause, that you can reverse it. You know, it just kind of makes sense logically. And so I just point out that very fact, you know, like if then the no's start piling up, and then I say, well, hopefully you see that there's work that still need to be done.
Yeah, that's smart. I like that. So, firstly, this has been fascinating. And I can really see the experience you've got with patients in the way that you're approaching this. I like the kind of sensitivity to understand the complexity of this group. So I really appreciate the work you're doing, Evan. Thank you.
Thank you.
The people that want to find out more about your work, say a bit about, obviously mention your website, but also some of the resources and some of the ways that people can work with you.
So my website is fixyourfatigue.org. That's FIXYOURFATIGUE.org. And so on the website, I've got a lot of information about me. There's videos that you can watch of a lot of the different interviews that I've and webinars and summits that I've been on. I also have information about all of the labs that I recommend, the supplements that I recommend, so that people can get some information that way. They can apply to get on a call with me to see if we're a good fit to work together. And I am in the process of creating a group coaching and membership community so that I can fulfill my mission, you know, because I'm on this mission to help 1 million people resolve their fatigue. There's no way that I can do that one-on-ones. And so I'm going through and I'm creating videos and I'm trying to automate this as much as possible so that people can get the help wherever they are financially and wherever they are on the course of this whole fatigue pathway so that they can really achieve their potential in their lives. That's kind of what I feel like I've been put here to do, is to help people get over fatigue so that they can live their mission and achieve their potential in their lives. So thank you for having me on so that I can continue to do this.
No, that's awesome. And also just to mention your book, Fix Your Fatigue is great as well. So that's another good place for people to dive in and find out more. Dr. Evan Hirsch, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure to understand more about you and the way that you work. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I really appreciate you having me on.